Thomas Boyd. Up next on Think, a former FBI deputy director on why he believes President Trump has been compromised by Russia, even if there's no evidence he is somehow taking orders from Vladimir Putin. Peter Strzok ran the investigations of Hillary Clinton's email and also of foreign election interference in 2016 and spent time on Robert Mueller's investigative team, but was later removed from the Mueller probe and fired from the FBI after somebody leaked text messages Strzok had sent to a colleague that were critical of President Trump. We'll talk about Strzok's investigations and what they revealed, about why he believes he was fired for political reasons, and about the likelihood that Russian operatives are trying to manipulate U.S. voter behavior this year. Our conversation starts after a short break. Russian intelligence agents are known for collecting compromising material as a tool for manipulating people. That compromat doesn't have to be anything salacious. It could be as simple as the knowledge that a prominent person said something publicly that doesn't match the private reality. When Donald Trump said in 2016 that he had no business dealings with Russia, while people who worked for him were actively exploring a deal to build a Trump Tower in Moscow, Russian intelligence knew about those talks. Could that be considered compromat? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Peter Strzok began his career with the FBI in 1996, rising through the ranks to become deputy director of counterintelligence. In that position, he ran both the investigation into Hillary Clinton's use of a private email server as Secretary of State and the probe into possible Russian efforts to influence the results of the 2016 election. He says that second investigation started not as a probe of the Trump campaign, but an effort to learn whether Russia posed a threat to the security of U.S. elections. The probe led to indictments against multiple Trump associates, most notably former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. Strzok was later fired in 2018 after the leak of text messages on his cell phone to another FBI agent that appeared to show an anti-Trump bias. His new book about all this is called Compromised: Counterintelligence and the Threat of Donald J. Trump. Peter, welcome to Think.
Chris, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Before we get started, I want to welcome new listeners joining us today on South Carolina Public Radio, Public Radio East in North Carolina, WQLN in Pennsylvania, Mississippi Public Broadcasting, and Jefferson Public Radio in California and Oregon. We're happy to have each of you with us. All right, Peter, I want to start talking about this title, Compromised. It's a pretty explosive allegation to make against the President of the United States. So let's begin by defining what that word means to somebody who works in counterintelligence.
Absolutely. So the idea of compromise is something that can be held over somebody that is that you can use to leverage their behavior or cause them to do something. It is what I used over the course of 20 years when I was recruiting people. It is what our foreign adversaries, particularly Russia, do very well. And that can be any number of things. I mean, you can look and it can be something that a financial entanglement or some sort of exposure there that isn't known. It could be something having to do with ego. It could be anything having to do with sort of an ideological affinity, but something that is there that isn't known, that if it were to become public, would cause harm or embarrassment or damage to somebody. That's the sort of thing that creates a that makes somebody compromised. And the Russians do this better than anybody else. You mentioned in your introduction that absolutely, when one looks at Trump, one of the biggest concerns that I had, that we had, were a number of these financial entanglements and how those might be used to compromise them. It's important to draw a distinction because there's nothing inherently wrong with having foreign business. What creates a problem is when there is a sort of financial interaction or a relationship that's hidden. And just by virtue of the fact that it is hidden, that gives power to the people who know about it to be able to influence the behavior. And that's what creates the compromise. And that's what we saw time and time again with the president.
All right, let's listen to Donald Trump as candidate Donald Trump in 2016.
I have nothing to do with Russia, folks, okay? I'll give you a written statement, nothing to do. But they tie me into Russia all the time. They like to tie me into Russia. And they say such bad things about Putin. And then they're supposed to negotiate with Putin? Why would he do this?
All right. So the Russians, according to the intelligence that you have, were aware that at the time he was making this statement in October of 2016, he was still asking his subordinates to pursue this deal for a Trump Tower in Moscow. This doesn't necessarily imply that he's taking marching orders from the Kremlin, right?
That's right. And that's absolutely correct. So the point to that clip was, I mean, clearly he is doubling down. He's lying when he says that. At that time, at that moment, he made that statement on the campaign trail. Michael Cohen, his personal attorney, was pursuing a deal for a Trump Tower in Moscow where they were proposing that Vladimir Putin would have the entire top floor. And so when he says that on the campaign trail, you know, Vladimir Putin knows that that isn't the truth. And so at any time, if he or anybody in Russia were to choose to expose the existence of these negotiations, that would be horribly damaging to Trump on the campaign trail. But it absolutely is accurate to your point that there are a variety of ways that when somebody's compromised that they can behave. And, you know, the worst case is something like a Manchurian candidate, right? Somebody who is aware that they've been recruited, they're taking tasking from the foreign power, they're usually using some sort of covert communications to do it. And that's sort of the worst case scenario. It's also, that was nothing that any of us, you know, seriously thought might be the case with the president. But the worry was, while none of us thought that was likely at any point, we also couldn't exclude it. And just saying that, just thinking that as a counterintelligence professional, that's a stunning sort of possibility to have to hold in your head. But again, you're right that in fact, it doesn't have to look like this fully witting agent. And in fact, I don't think that was the case of what was and what is the current situation with Trump.
So look, I don't even know what this question says about where we are now and the kinds of things we've become accustomed to. But even the president's supporters will admit that he bends the truth now and then. He will. It depends, you know, who you're talking to. If you say the president tells lies or you say the president just sort of exaggerates things and doesn't focus on the facts, what would make this particular falsehood stick to him in a different way than other things that he has said that are demonstrably not true?
I think that this is something that's in the hand of it's in the hand of a hostile foreign power. So this isn't somebody who's a political rival or somebody in the U.S. media who might use it. And, you know, it's expected to be sort of the rough and tumble of U.S. politics. This is something in the hands of not only a foreign nation, but a foreign nation that has thousands of nuclear weapons pointed at us right now. And the other thing that you have to be concerned about is that these aren't sort of just, you know, yes, he's an embellisher. Yes, he exaggerates. Yes, he's a showman. But the fact of the matter is that there is something there that is causing him to engage in all of this behavior that just isn't explainable from a national security perspective. You know, when he, you know, everybody out there who's got a daughter or a son in the military or a brother or a sister or a parent in the military, and they're fighting in Afghanistan or they're fighting in Syria, when something comes up that, you know, it turns out Russia is putting a bounty on the head of American soldiers in Afghanistan, when Russia rams a vehicle of American servicemen in Syria, seriously injuring a bunch of them, and our president refuses to do anything, the question then becomes not so much like, well, you know, what he says may or may not be true, and it's just blustering and part of his character. The question then becomes, all right, well, is there something out there more than just these statements? Are there other sort of financial entanglements? You know, is there money involved? Are there other sorts of motive factors that are causing him to do these things that absolutely make no sense from a U.S. national security perspective, but that absolutely help Russia's national security? And that's the sort of cause for concern when you start looking to what these sort of motivational forces are that are hidden and might be held over him.
So way back when this first came to your attention in July of 2016, when you were working in counterintelligence with the FBI, why did you initially not want to open an investigation specifically into Donald Trump?
Because we didn't have the allegations at the time that he had engaged in activity that would meet the threshold to open a case. I mean, in the FBI, there are very specific guidelines which have been developed over years and, you know, oversight and some of the excesses of the J. Edgar Hoover era and just, you know, building out the FBI's regulations about what we can and cannot open a case. And so the FBI has always had a primary mission of protecting the United States against foreign intelligence activity. That is especially the Russians and especially the Chinese, but it goes to every foreign nation around the world who's in the U.S. trying to conduct intel activity. So as part of that, of course, we're watching the Russians. And we're going to watch Russians forever. I mean, that would be part of the FBI's mission as long as they exist. But when we received in 2016 allegations. They were very specific allegations that a guy by the name of George Papadopoulos had met with a foreign diplomat in Europe and told him that a member of the Trump campaign had received an offer of assistance from the government of Russia, that they had information damaging to Obama and Clinton, and they offered to coordinate the release of that information. So that's a tangible fact, right? That's a tangible allegation. And figuring out who on the Trump campaign might have received that was the purpose for the investigation. We didn't open a case on Trump. We didn't open a case on the campaign. There was never a case on the campaign. That was something that partisan spin came out later. But initially, it was very focused on that discrete allegation. And all of that was sort of under this broad umbrella of trying to understand what Russia is doing and protecting the United States against those Russian activities.
Okay, that diplomat was Australia's ambassador to the UK, who remembered that President Trump, remembered that George Papadopoulos had told him this before DC leaks or WikiLeaks had those emails. Why was that significant?
Well, it was significant because we knew throughout the spring that with increasing certainty that the Russians had been behind a series of break-ins on the cyber in the cyber front against both DNC and DCCC servers and other data systems, and that they'd stolen a lot of information. And then suddenly, in mid-late July of 2016, there was a massive release of information that had been stolen through WikiLeaks. And it was something that, you know, was very was seized on very quickly in the political debate of the general elections that were approaching. And so when that came out, the reason that was important was that was essentially what, and I can't, you know, I cannot confirm who specifically that foreign ambassador was, although, you know, there is a foreign ambassador who has made very specific statements that he had a meeting with Papadopoulos. The U.S. government has not released that information, so I can't confirm that. But when that person heard and saw that release of information, it lined up almost immediately with what George Papadopoulos had said months before. So either Papadopoulos is a clairvoyant, or it sure sounds like Papadopoulos had inside information about what the Russians had done before even the U.S. government knew about it. So upon hearing that, that memory of what they might have assigned of just Papadopoulos, you know, exaggerating or being full of hot air, when it lined up with this bombshell release of all these stolen emails, it suddenly brought those that past memory and that past statement together with the reality of what was occurring. And that's what caused them such alarm that they reached out to the United States.
And at that point, you say the statement rattling over and over in your brain was, "This is not normal. This is not normal." At this point, I think a lot of listeners have heard so much about all this that Americans may assume this sort of intrigue is par for the course in elections. Not so.
Not at all. I mean, I worked in six administrations doing counterintelligence, Democrats and Republicans. There is and have studied the counterintelligence history of the modern era. And without exaggeration, there has never been a president with anywhere near the number of counterintelligence vulnerabilities, not only him, but people surrounding him, in modern presidential history. It truly is unprecedented. And part of what, you know, we've become numbed in some way to sort of just the outrage of today's day and age. And, you know, however much people might shake their head at something, the next day brings something even more equally outrageous. And we forget about even what happened last week, let alone last month or last year. But when you step back, if you go and look at the history books, particularly from a counterintelligence perspective, what this administration and Trump have in terms of counterintelligence vulnerabilities is unprecedented, and it isn't even close. And that's what I'm trying to lay out, you know, that argument and the facts supporting that argument are what I try and lay out in the book.
How do they get security clearances with those intelligence vulnerabilities?
Well, it's interesting. Many of them were recommended that they not be granted clearances and were overruled by Trump. I mean, there's been public reporting in that both Jared Kushner and Ivanka had been, that the CIA, amongst others, had recommended that they not be given security clearances. And it went up to, I believe, either National Security Advisor General McMaster or the Chief of Staff at the time. It may have been General Kelly, but I don't know who it was. And they recommended that they not be given clearances, and Trump overruled it. And of course, the president has the ultimate authority to grant access to classified information. And so he did, against the recommendation of his own staff and his own intelligence community.
My guest is Peter Strzok. He served with the FBI from 1996 to 2018. He rose to the level of deputy of the Counterintelligence Division. His new book is called Compromised: Counterintelligence and the Threat of Donald J. Trump. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Peter Strzok, who served with the FBI from 1996 to 2018, rising to the level of deputy of the Counterintelligence Division. His new book is called Compromised: Counterintelligence and the Threat of Donald J. Trump. All right, Peter, you also ran the investigation codenamed Mid-Year Exam. This was the one about Hillary Clinton's use of a private email server. I have to confess, I've tried for years to really understand the details of exactly what needed to be tracked down. I'm still a little bit hazy about this possible mishandling of emails when she was Secretary of State. Just quickly, what was the concern there, and what is the standard the FBI has for opening an investigation into this sort of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. So the case was opened based on a referral from the Inspector General of the intelligence community, who had seen identified classified information in some of the unclassified emails that were being turned over by Clinton and the State Department to both Congress as well as some Freedom of Information Act requests. Now, ordinarily, that there's a kind of gray area about whether or not at what point something, you know, if information, classified information, is inadvertently put into a unclassified email, sometimes that's just an administrative oversight. But if a certain set of, you know, criteria are met, that can represent a violation of the law. And so there was enough material there that the decision that the FBI made was to, and this was before I was brought on board, was to open a case to figure out essentially what came down to three things. The first thing was, what was the totality of classified information that was placed into an unclassified email, to go out and scour the ends of the earth and all across the State Department and everywhere else to get this entire body of material so that we could conclusively say, here's the classified information that was placed into this unclassified format. The second big sort of thrust of the investigation was to try and figure out, why was it put there? You know, was this something where somebody did it inadvertently? Or maybe it was a life or death situation in a war, in a, you know, a theater of war overseas where something had to get done, and so it was done just because it needed to be in an exigent sort of way. And why and who did all the placement of that classified information? And then the third big investigative thrust was to figure out, okay, who, if anybody, got a hold of that classified information? In other words, did somebody like the Russians or the Chinese or even some hacker break in, and were they able to get this classified information? And if they were, what, if anything, did the U.S. government need to do to protect against that potential loss of classified information?
Did your team look specifically for evidence that Clinton or her staff deleted any work emails so that they wouldn't be available for inspection?
We sure did. I mean, we looked, and again, keep in mind that we went across, you know, literally we sent people around the world to almost to every continent except for the Arctic and to look for these emails, because, you know, email is, it has a sender, and then of course the receiver also gets a copy of that, and if they forward it on, whoever they forward it to, you know, gets a copy of it. If it's replied, it shows up in the kind of the stack of the chain of the email beneath it. So in many cases, when we were going out, we were looking and getting not one, not two, but four, five, six copies of the same email at various points along the thread. And throughout that process, we were looking to find whether or not any email had been deleted. And we didn't find evidence of that happening. I mean, certainly what made it complex was that Secretary Clinton wanted a convenient system where she had one BlackBerry that she could do all her personal emailing and all her business emailing. And what confused this, and what's been taken up as a rallying cry, was that when it came to produce the email, she didn't turn over what we estimate to be about 30,000 non-work-related emails. And so the question always was, you know, was there material that she didn't turn over that in fact really was a work-related email? And either it was an oversight, or maybe it was really embarrassing, or maybe it was even illegal. But when we checked, and again, we weren't only looking at Secretary Clinton and all her staff and all her companies that she used for these email servers. We were going out to every single other person who received those emails, who sent those emails to her. So we were getting multiple copies. And at the end of the day, we just didn't see evidence that she had deleted any work-related emails that should have been turned over.
I understand that the FBI is a large and well-resourced agency, but do you have any sense that the focus on the Clinton emails on Operation Mid-Year Exam was a distraction to the extent that it kept you or your colleagues from spotting possible Russian election interference earlier?
I do worry about that. You know, once we opened the case, once we opened Mid-Year Exam, we had to do it well. I mean, every FBI case needs to be done well, but particularly this case that involved one of the candidates for the presidency of the United States. We knew that Congress and everybody else was going to be looking at it up, down, left, and right. We had to do it in a very thorough, professional, complete manner. The other thing we knew was that the election was coming. Now, there was never any sort of deadline put on us by Director Comey or anybody else that you have to have it done by a certain date. But there was certainly a strong sense that we need to get this done well. And we also, the sooner we can get it done well, the better. And so that caused, if you're going to do that, you need to put a decent amount of resources on it. And we had an extraordinary team. I mean, one of the best teams I ever worked with during my career at the FBI. And yet what we were investigating, if you take away the fact that it was one of the candidates for president of the United States, the underlying fact pattern was really a very run-of-the-mill sort of mishandling a classified information case that just occurs on a routine basis in the FBI. And so for those investigators, for me, for the managers, and certainly for the senior membership leadership of the FBI, I do have some concern looking back that all the time and attention that we were placing on Mid-Year caused us to not be focused on any number of other things, just because you only have such a finite amount of attention and time in a day. And, you know, would we have seen Russian interference sooner had we not been so focused on the Mid-Year Exam investigation? Perhaps. And it's something I worry about to this day.
All right. Switching gears back to Operation Crossfire Hurricane, which was the probe into Russian election interference. One of the people that you knew you wanted to speak to directly was Michael Flynn. And the encounter that you describe in the book is really extraordinary. At this point, he was already serving in the White House. He was like, yeah, come on over. At what point in that interview were you aware that he was making false statements to you?
When we started repeating the question using the phrases that he had used himself in his discussions with Russian Ambassador Kislyak, I mean, taking a step back, but you got to understand, I mean, he had, by the time we showed up to interview him, he had had multiple conversations with all kinds of people in the White House. He had them with the vice president. He had them with the chief of staff. He had them with the press secretary. There had been all kinds of editorials in the Washington Post and elsewhere, specifically talking about the conversations that Flynn had had with the Russian ambassador, where he asked them a couple of things. One, to vote a certain way in a UN vote prior to Trump being inaugurated. And the other thing was to not escalate or engage in any sort of tit-for-tat response to the Obama administration's imposition of sanctions for Russian attacks on the U.S. election. So he knew why we were there. And in fact, he told Deputy Director McCabe when he was setting up the meeting, he's like, well, you know what I said. You have those calls. And so, you know, for us to walk in and having the expectation that, you know, he knew why we were there. He said he didn't want an attorney. He just, you know, had given us a tour of the West Wing. He's very relaxed. And we asked him a question that we all know is the elephant in the room. He knows it's coming because he's had all these conversations about it. And he doesn't tell us the truth. And so then we go back a second time. And we go back a third time in some cases. And we're using the exact phrases that he had used in his conversation with the ambassador, the Russian ambassador, to, if not to jar his memory, to just give him some sort of fig leaf that he could say, oh, great, yeah, you're right. That's a great reminder. Thank you. Here's the truth. But he never did. He never came out with the truth. And to this day, I can't tell you why.
So he pled guilty to felony charges for lying in 2017. Then at the beginning of this year, he withdrew that plea. The DOJ announced plans in May to drop all charges against him. From the perspective of the FBI, as far as you know, has anything changed with regard to the statements Flynn made to you and other investigators?
Nothing. And look, you got to, it's not only just that he pled guilty twice to two different judges. He did it in writing, and then he did it again standing in person in front of the judge verbally. And if you've been to a guilty plea, that is not just a, oh, hey, is this right? Okay, fine, get out of here. The judge universally will go through a very detailed set of questions to make sure that the person pleading guilty is well aware of what they're pleading guilty to. And the other thing to remember, this isn't some 18-year-old scared kid. This isn't somebody who got on the wrong side and they're terrified and they got pushed into doing something that they didn't really know what they were doing. This was a three-star general who had served in combat, who was the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, and had been at the time the National Security Advisor of the United States of America. There's no way that somebody, a general officer with three stars, doesn't A, have a heightened responsibility to tell the truth when he's talking to anyone, let alone an FBI agent, but two, that he should have any sort of illusions of what is going on and what the truth is. It just, and so again, for the facts that we had at the time, they simply haven't changed. And when I see what the Department of Justice is doing now, trying to pull back this plea, they have filings right now in the District of Columbia that are at odds with each other. They contradict each other and they're sitting there pending in front of the court. And all I can say is that I look at this as one of the most egregious miscarriages of justice that I've experienced in my career.
The Obama White House knew the basic outlines of this investigation. It was getting underway in the summer and then fall of 2016. What sort of conversations are you aware of within the White House debating whether or not to comment on this publicly?
Well, so I want to clarify that a little bit. To my knowledge, the Obama administration did not know the individual cases about U.S. persons that we had underway.
Okay.
They were certainly aware from us, from the CIA, from the NSA, and from the other members of the intelligence community that Russia was actively attacking our elections and were doing things like, you know, probing our voting infrastructure and doing things on the cyber front. But what they didn't know, what and traditionally there is a wall about, you know, kind of the FBI's investigations and the White House, we don't talk about that, we don't share it. And so while they were aware roughly of what Russia was doing and Russia's attempts to interfere in the election, they were not aware of the sort of the cases that we were doing that we had opened in the summer, or certainly, excuse me, what we were looking at as the fall approached into the and through the election.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, I want to go to the phones. First off, we have Zachary calling from Austin, Texas. Hi, Zachary.
Hi, yes, thank you. Very interesting program so far. Question, what threshold of evidence would be needed before those and with the power to do so would actually consider holding Trump to account?
Thanks for calling.
Zachary, that's a great question. And, you know, part of the issue comes up and part of the debate that we had and the difficult time we were having is that, of course, the president enjoys certain immunities while he is the president. And, you know, it's part of what you saw in the Mueller report where they held back and said, you know, if we, you know, we cannot indict a sitting president, but essentially we're laying out all this information. And if we could conclude that he was, you know, innocent, we would have so stated. You know, there are other remedies, you know, impeachment and things like that. And of course, the kind of landscape changes once the president has left office. But it's a really, I'm not an attorney, but, you know, we had really bright attorneys trying to think through this. And, you know, to the extent of having big sort of grids on a whiteboard talking about, you know, crimes committed before office, crimes committed during office, crimes committed after office, you know, what the sanctions are before office, while in office, after office. And all of this is against the backdrop of not only really complicated legal and constitutional issues, but then there's this whole idea of like, you know, who is the FBI to investigate the president? Who are we, you know, particularly when you look at, you know, sort of the history of J. Edgar Hoover and, you know, the president is the head of the executive branch. Is it appropriate for the FBI to be investigating, you know, one thing to investigate people around him, which is how it started. But eventually when we do open a case on him, is, you know, what's the legality of that? Who should approve that? And it was something that, you know, in many ways, these were unprecedented decisions. And at the end of the day, I think, you know, you have to be able, it can't be true that a president is absolutely immune from the law. that he can not only break the law, but he cannot be investigated. And it also doesn't make sense, I think, to say, well, he can break the law, but you have to wait until he's no longer president to go investigate it, you know, 4 years or 8 years later. That doesn't seem to make sense. But it's a great question, and it's a really, really tough question. So, you know, we tried our best to do both what the law and regulation told us and it sounds a little corny, but what our oath of office told us and what the American people would expect.
All right, next on the phone to Anthony, calling us from Bluffton, South Carolina. Hi, Anthony.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just recently finished a book by Tom Burris that alleges that Donald Trump has been laundering money for Russian oligarchs since 2008. I'd like to hear Mr. Strzok's opinion on that.
Thanks for calling.
Well, there's been a lot of written about Trump's business empire. And yeah, I'll caveat this by saying I can't comment about things that I knew from the inside, from investigations. So what I'm going to answer that question is what's been written about in the media and what I've seen. You know, there's certainly, I think, a lot of very credible reporting that talks about the Trump business empire going back both his real estate holdings, his hotels and licensing type operations, his casinos, and that many of those businesses are very suitable to launder money. And that when you look at Trump, you know, statements like his son Eric in 2014, I think it was, you know, we don't rely on American banks. We have all the funding we need out of Russia. And then you combine statements like that with the recent New York Times reporting about his taxes, where he owes, you know, upwards of almost $450 million in debt that's coming due, that we don't know who holds that debt. We know that he made over $73 million in income from foreign sources between 2007 and 2018. There's absolutely a concern when you look at the sort of businesses that he has. And remember, too, when he entered the government, he filled out a Office of Government Ethics form, which you have to list all your business holdings and where you have a controlling interest. He listed over, I think it was over 450, maybe 550 LLCs, sort of individual, you know, companies or corporations that are formed that he had an interest in. And so in that environment where you see a lot of kind of oligarchs and people who are dancing around, if not completely in bed with organized crime figures, that certainly raises a lot of concern about the propriety of money. And of course, that absolutely is exactly the sort of compromising leverage that if you were engaged in some sort of illegal activity,
gotta
you
jump
could use
in.
To hold over him.
My guest is Peter Strzok. He was deputy of the Counterintelligence Division of the FBI. We'll be right back. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Peter Strzok, who was deputy of the FBI's Counterintelligence Division. His new book is called Compromised, Counterintelligence and the Threat of Donald J. Trump. Peter, what role were you assigned in being attached to the office of the special counsel under Robert Mueller?
So I set up the office with him, particularly the FBI component of that. After he was appointed, we had been running these investigations for many months at that point. I mean, he almost, not quite a year, but I think 8 months at the time. So we had to get his initial team up to speed and then went about setting up the office. And what that meant was, you know, how to structure it, you know, how we were going to make teams, what those teams would be focused on, the composition of those teams, and then bringing in all the right folks, whether it's agents or analysts or forensic accountants and all the things that you need to effectively work what turned out to be a very, very complex series of investigations.
And then things changed for you. How concerned were you when internal investigators started looking into personal text messages between you and another FBI employee that came across to outsiders as critical of the president?
Well, initially I wasn't worried. I mean, I knew I had, grumbled is probably, probably too gentle a word. I was, used pretty frank and sometimes coarse language to, comment on my opinion of Trump at the time. But when I heard about that, I, sort of thought, well, okay, that's fine. So they're going to see that I was grumbling about my personal political opinion and it wouldn't be a big deal. And boy, I was really wrong about that.
So you argue in the book FBI agents have the same rights to an opinion in private as anybody else in America. Why share those opinions on a government-issued phone?
Oh, well, no question about it. If I could do it over, I would not have done that. I mean, that was the kind of thing that, again, it was a back and forth that I also make the point that, just because something is allowed doesn't necessarily make it smart. And, this, no question about it, was not a smart place to do it. The rules allow personal use of government devices like that. So, agents talk to their doctor, to their clergyman, to their attorneys all the time. But again, just because you're allowed to do it doesn't make it smart to do it. And I definitely wasn't smart in my judgment then.
So what was the situation with Robert Mueller when he became aware of these investigations?
It was, Director Mueller is a very, he's a former Marine. He does not suffer fools lightly. He is very stern. And I went in expecting to, they kind of came out and I knew sort of the scope of them. And in some ways, it was a very subdued conversation. I mean, I think there was a sense of regret from him, and there certainly was from me. And it was one of those circumstances where, it was almost, I would have rather have had my butt chewed, because that would have been better than, sometimes one of those, when there's somebody you respect deeply, if they're, a quiet disappointment and sadness is 1,000 times worse than them cussing you out. And that's what it was. So it was a very short conversation. There was not a lot said. I think there was, again, sort of a regret and a sadness, but an understanding that for the greater good of the special counsel's work, that I needed to go back to the FBI.
To be clear, this is all happening sort of privately within these teams of people. Do you have any idea who leaked information about those texts to the media?
I do. And, I'm suing the government right now. I think the release was illegal, as well as my eventual firing. But I think there were two sets of releases. One was when both the New York Times and the Washington Post became aware of the sort of political nature of the text, that somebody, I think out of the White House or DOJ, but I think we'll find out through discovering the lawsuit, released that information illegally to those two outlets. And then much later, I know it was the Department of Justice. They invited reporters in the middle of the night, had them sat them down with the texts, made them swear that they couldn't say that they got access through the Department of Justice. And they did that all to kind of take the spotlight away from the Deputy Attorney General, who was going up to testify on the Hill the following day. So there are those two disclosures, both of which I think were illegal, and the lawsuit's proceeding. So we'll see what it turns up.
I don't know if you can comment on this. Are you suing for damages, or do you want your job back?
I don't want to get into sort of details about what the what the outcome is that I'm looking for. But certainly, I think it was a wrongful termination. I want to retire as an FBI agent. I was about a year away from being able to do that. I had a long, 20, 24, almost 25 year career doing that. I think the firing was illegal. And again, to be able to make that right, to go and then sit and retire as an agent, is certainly, I think, an appropriate, with whatever else is part of what I would like to see happen.
All right. There are lots of Americans who believe that Robert Mueller and his team dug very deep, looked high and low for evidence that there was some kind of Trump campaign collusion with Russia and didn't find it. The president himself has characterized himself as totally exonerated. Was Mueller looking for evidence he could use to indict the president in some way? Can you give me some clarification on that?
Yeah, absolutely. So the first thing is the Director Mueller's report in no way exonerated the president. If you read that, if you don't pay attention to what you're hearing on cable news, don't pay attention to what you're hearing your congressman or senator say, go pick up that report, and it is going to paint a damning portrait of connections between Russia and the campaign. And if you don't want to read Mueller's report, then go pick up the nearly 1,000-page Senate Intelligence Committee report, a committee, by the way, led by Republicans, who issued a bipartisan report that Senator Burr and Senator Rubio and the entirety of the Republican members of that committee signed out. And you can go through 1,000 pages of really damning connections between Trump, his campaign, his administration, and the government of Russia. But I think to the question about whether or not that sort of the type of information and report that the Senate Intelligence Committee did, that was the sort of work that Director Mueller simply wasn't going to do. The special counsel regulations, when you look at Director Mueller's appointment order that actually kind of lays out the boundaries of what he can and can't do, and even the way the teams were structured, those were looking very specifically at violations of law. What he wasn't going to do, what the regulations don't allow him to do, the special counsel regs don't talk about counterintelligence activity. They don't talk about intelligence activity. That is squarely, though, in the wheelhouse of the FBI. And that was something when I went over that, you know, I said, look, we're going to have to do it. And the understanding, you know, having had this discussion with Director Mueller and his senior leadership was, yep, that the FBI folks in doing this, that is squarely part of your mission. We understand you're going to do it. That's a really hard task. And when you, again, looking at the scope of this activity, it probably would have been the biggest counterintelligence case or investigation in the FBI's history. My worry is that after I left, you know, particularly when I see some of the statements in, you know, in like Andrew Weissman's book and from others, I have some concern that that wasn't ever completely done. And that's to our nation's detriment. We really need to understand what the Russians were doing in 2016.
Let's go to Redlands, California. Caroline is on the line. Hi, Caroline.
Hi, Peter. How are you doing?
Hey, good, Caroline. How are you?
I'm doing great. I follow you online on Twitter, and I see you get a fair share of hate on there. So I want to let you know that you have a lot of support. A lot of people really respect, and I'm very, very just happy that you're out there speaking truth to power. So thank you very much. My question is, I see a lot of radicalized Americans with what's going on now, and I have a concern. I'm worried that we're headed for a big conflict, especially with Trump not committing to peaceful transfer of power. As a person coming from the inside, do you have any idea how we go? What's next, Peter? We're kind of like, I'm at a loss. So I'm wondering if, you know, what can you tell us? Is there anything you can tell us to assuage our fears?
Thanks for calling.
So a couple of things, and thanks for your question and your support and kind words. I think the FBI, certainly, and the people I saw not only in the FBI, but around the U.S. intelligence community and the U.S. government, they are good patriotic Americans. They believe in America. At the end of the day, they grew up here. They went to the same civics lessons that all of us had. Many of them served in the military beforehand, and including the people who are still in the military now, all of them who took an oath of office and almost universally take that oath really, really seriously. So I do think that, you know, in the worst case, people do understand at the working level that their duty is to the Constitution and to the American people and not to any one man or woman. I am really concerned about the, you know, what you said, and, you know, you saw it online, and I think all of us have. The sort of tenor of the debate is really escalating. And I think, you know, any leader, if you think about it, you know, a leader in your family, your mother, your father, a leader in a troop organization, the leader of our nation, needs to be standing up and telling people, hey, calm this down. Let's lower the temperature. Let's lower the tone. We have our differences, but let's talk them out. And setting an example of a dialogue that brings people together. What worries the heck out of me is we're seeing the opposite out of the White House. I mean, Trump is running on a platform of divisiveness. He is seemingly running around with a bucket of gasoline looking for any sort of flashpoint in our society and taking sides and trying to aggravate it. That's the opposite of what we need to be doing. And I'm really concerned, as you are, I think, that when we do get to the election, you know, everybody's going to want to know an answer right away. Everybody's going to know if there's a fight, how it's going to end up, whether it's a court fight or, you know, some problem with a voting machine. And what we're going to need more than ever during that time are people with voices of calm and voices of strength just saying, wait, let's do this right. We're going to figure it out. Let's not make hasty accusations or get in fights. And my concern is that everything from our president to the nature of our media and news today is poised to do the opposite, to just try and, you know, get clicks or, you know, get the word out first. So I'm concerned, as you are, about what that's going to look like. I do have a lot of faith in professional government employees and our military. But certainly, when you see that being challenged in some places, like it has been with this administration, it does give me cause for worry.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. So we're just a few weeks away now from another presidential election. The sitting president, Donald Trump, is warning Americans almost daily about the potential for fraud, especially with mail-in ballots. How worried are you that American citizens are actually committing voter fraud in significant numbers? And I know that that specifically wasn't a focus area of your investigations, but how worried are you about that as compared with how worried you are that Russian operatives are trying to convince us to be worried about that?
Look, I am not at all worried about widespread voter fraud. Historical data has shown, and the director, FBI Director Wray, as recently as a couple of weeks ago, stated to Congress openly that there is no historical example that the FBI is aware of any sort of large-scale voting fraud. And that's been backed up by academic studies throughout very prestigious institutions. And I think Americans can be very confident that they can go out and vote in a way that is going to be not subject to massive fraud. I am very worried about what the Russians are doing. I think the divisive sort of place we find ourselves right now is very ripe for Russian disinformation. I'm particularly discouraged when I see that same disinformation being picked up and used, particularly by some Republicans in Congress in both the House and the Senate. I find that reprehensible. I mean, everybody understands you're going to engage in sort of the rough and tumble of the domestic political process, but don't use the disinformation of a hostile foreign nation to do it. That's not a Republican value. That's not a Democratic value. I mean, our just being a patriotic American should tell us we would never do something like that. So I think, I don't doubt there will be some challenges on the election. I think absolutely everybody, though, should be out there voting early, whether that's in person, whether it's by mail. And again, whoever you vote for, research and vote your conscience. But gosh, this year more than ever, get out and vote. And I hope every one of your listeners does.
So you were fired from the FBI in 2018. Among your colleagues who remain, are you able to tell us anything definitive about the general tenor of morale there?
Well, I think it's challenging. I mean, I think, again, people are in the FBI and in government because they are drawn to public service. You're not going to you can make a comfortable living, but you're never going to be rich. I think people do it because they believe in the job and they believe in America. And that doesn't depend on who's in office and what they're saying. So the ability to go out and work investigations to bring justice on behalf of the American people for the American people is a really strong motivator. But at the same time, I know that people are, that there has been a chilling effect by some of the statements and actions of this administration. And I'm worried where that manifests itself. And certainly if it's to the point where people are, maybe potential sources aren't willing to work with us because they see how sources are getting turned over and exposed by Congress. Maybe a foreign nation isn't willing to share intelligence with us because they see what's being declassified by this Director of National Intelligence. I am worried that the actions of this administration are harming the ability of the FBI and other government agencies to do their work.
Peter Strzok was Deputy Director of Counterintelligence at the FBI. His new book is called Compromised: Counterintelligence and the Threat of Donald J. Trump. Peter, thank you for making time for us.
Chris, thanks so much for having me. It was great to be here.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're on Twitter at KERA Think. You can subscribe to the Think podcast wherever you get podcasts. Just type KERA Think into the search bar or catch up on what you missed at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.